Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamau Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamau Murray, and we are here 2023 with the first podcast of the year. We're starting off the Australian Open swing with a former Australian Open champ. But first, let's take a preview about what we think is going to happen this year. On the women's side, I personally think Jessica Pegula over the past 60 to 90 days has been the best player in tennis. I think this will be the year where she squeaks out a Grand Slam. Probably won't happen on clay, but she's got three chances. I think she plays well in Australia. Her game suits grass. And again, an American playing at the U.S. Open. You know, if she's healthy all year, this could be her year to potentially get a Grand Slam champion. On the men's side, we see Novak Djokovic being able to play Australian Open. And I think this is the year where he pulls away from Rafa and Federer and wins at least two of the four majors this year. And we start off with a South African, two-time Australian Open champion in 1981 and 1982, back when the Australian Open was played on grass, Johan Kriek. We talk extensively about what it was like playing in that era, why he chose to be raised on clay court tennis, but skipped the French Open for five consecutive years. We talk about growing tennis in Africa and being a tennis dad now with his own academy and two young stars coming up in tennis. Take a listen. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. This is the podcast number one of 2023. And we're getting ready for the Australian Open. And we've got a guest who probably is one of the best guests to kick us off for the Australian Open, Johan Kriek, 1981 and 82 Australian Open champion, back when Australian Open was on grass, right? A legend from South Africa, one of the great guys on the tour, wins over Johnny McEnroe, dad to two rising stars. Johan, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Kamau. Nice to meet you.
So it's Australian Open time. And, you know, back in the day, people didn't want to make the trek all the way to Australia. So tell me what that was like in 81, 82 when you won, back when it was on grass. I mean, I don't even know if most people in my era remember the day. I was born in 80. So I don't think I ever knew the Australian Open was ever a grass court event. Tell me about those times.
Yeah, it was a golden era of tennis with the Connors, Borg, McEnroe, Ash, and Nastasi era. I mean, I played with basically almost four generations of players, four different types of rackets. I played with white balls at Wimbledon, then I switched it to yellow balls in 84. I mean, I played so many things. What people don't realize is back in the 70s that three of the majors were played on grass. Mm. You had the Australian Open, mm-hmm. and you had Wimbledon. And they had the U.S. Open on grass at Forest Hills.
Yeah.
And the only one was on clay. There was nothing on hard courts. Now you have, you know, obviously Roland Garros is on red clay and you got Wimbledon that's still grass. But then you have the Australian and the U.S. Open on hard courts. So it's changed quite a bit. When I played in the late 70s, early 80s, most of my career was in the 80s successfully. The Australian Open was always the last tournament of the year. And, you know, it didn't have the cachet, didn't have the prize money or any of that stuff, even though it was a major, so to speak, on paper. It didn't have the financial workings like you have with the U.S. Open or Wimbledon or even the French Open. So it was a very different era for the Masters and then for the major tournament. So but I went down there, and my first two times I didn't qualify. I was already on the tour, obviously, in 81, 82. I was already top 10 in the world, but I played very well and, you know, just played Steve Denton in the finals twice and beat him in both finals. The first year was a 7-6, and the fourth was a tough one. And in the second year, I played him in straight sets. It was a little bit easier, but yeah, it was a great sight and a really good run for me.
Now, when did that change? Because right now, I see the Australian Open as probably the most forward of the slams. They were like the first ones to have the LED boards all around the bowl of the court. You know, and the players initially thought it was annoying because you serve a ball, it hit the LED board before the ball kid gets a hand on it, and the ball bounces back in the court. Now right. The LED board is used to create more advertising, right, to create more sort of digital and imagery and color to the court, and so to modernize it. And even Australian Open is probably one of the first to publicly advertise prize money increase. I mean, very public about 3% increase from last year, you know what I mean? So when did that sort of shift where it was sort of the last tour of the year to now being the first tour of the year and being
Very interesting. I mean, the old Australian Open was played at Kooyong, which is the very famous old Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall era tournament that was played there right on the Yarra River. It's not that far from where it is today.
Yeah.
The new site, but, you know, it was an old club and, you know, to make room for the new and improved version, they had to switch sites. So they went to Flinders Park and then, you know, I think the Australian Open switched in 86, maybe. Mm. I was starting to have some issues with my elbow and I was injured a little bit. So I played there against Edberg, lost to him. And I think he won it that year. But nevertheless, and I think 86, 87, they changed it over to hard courts and then the new facility. And obviously over the last number of years, they've improved that site and improved the tournament. And, you know, rightfully so, the Australian Open has become an iconic Grand Slam event. And I just think it's really probably the most fun one because it's obviously played in a very fun city of Melbourne, very much a European feeling city and trams and all that stuff. I always had a great time in Australia, played very well there over the years. And, you know, just it was a great era to see it improve like that. But it's a fantastic tournament now. Very proud to see that a South African runs it for the last number of years. Craig out of Champaign, Illinois. He was the coach there in college. He was working with Kevin Anderson, also from South Africa. I guess he recruited him. Yeah. So Craig has done a magnificent job for the state of Victoria. And, you know, he's an iconic tennis operator.
Oh, 100%. So I'm from Chicago. So Craig Tiley is an Illinois legend, right? Coaching there at U of I. You know, brought Kevin Anderson over and, you know, Kevin Anderson, as we know, got to the 2017 U.S. Open final. Same year Sloan won the U.S. Open that year. So that was a great run. And Craig, and I mean, from the per diem, from the food, from the salon at the place, I mean, it just is a first-class event. So
it's kind of funny. You know, I don't know if people really recognize it. And I don't want to digress from this subject matter. But I'm kind of proud of the South Africans that have done a major job on tennis since the 60s. Let me give you an example. You know, Craig Tiley is the modern day guru for Grand Slam events and has obviously built up a fantastic tournament with the Australian Open. But there was another gentleman by the name of Owen Williams, who was South African born. He was a pro player in the 60s. He's now probably deep into his 80s. I used to have, when I played the South African Open back in the early 80s and 80s, it was a difficult time because it was apartheid era. I was blackballed, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I tried to support South African tennis. And I ended up winning the tournament in 1983 when Owen Williams was a tournament director in Johannesburg. What people don't realize is that the South African Open was the fifth oldest tournament in the world after the four majors. And so when South Africa switched governments in 93, within a couple of years, the South African Open had completely disappeared. The whole South African Tennis Union was running to the ground, was bankrupt. And so in order to pay off the bills in South Africa, they sold the date to a tournament in Barcelona. I think it was Madrid. And so Owen Williams ran the South African Open from the early 60s. And by the late 60s, he decided that there may be a different way to make these tournaments more successful, more viable, more prize money. And Owen is the grandfather or the founder of the sponsor tent and the box seats around center courts. He was the original guy that started it, South African.
Huh.
And so by the late 60s, the Forest Hills USTA folks said, you know, there's some guy down in South Africa who's doing an amazing job at taking a big tournament and making it extremely successful financially. And we need to talk to this guy. And so if you want to read about this era of the box seats and the sponsor tents and how professional tennis is where it is today, there's a couple of people that are very key players. One is Lamar Hunt, that will never get the accolades that he deserves, from Dallas, Texas, who started WCT Tour, as well as this guy, Owen Williams, who was a South African businessman, former tennis pro, who has a very, very keen sense of how to make money with tennis. And he started the box seats. So the USDA hired him to run Forest Hills at the US Open, at Forest Hills and at the Flushing Meadows. So I don't think he was there at Flushing Meadows, but he was at Forest Hills for about 4 or 5 years, then went back to South Africa. And that's why the US Open is today one of the richest tournaments, not because of just him, but just these ideas have been flourished and, you know, became bigger and bigger as the, and now everybody around the world. I mean, if you don't have sponsors with box seats and sponsor tents and dinners and lunches and sponsor parties and all that stuff, you know, we would not see the increases in prize money. Yeah. So he was really kind of the founder of bringing big corporations to tennis. Interesting story. He wrote a book called Ahead of the Game. You should read it. Fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, another famous South African, Ilana Kloss.
Yeah. Ilana's in Chicago.
Yeah, Ilana's Chicago, you know, New York, you know, split time Chicago, New York, but spouse to Billy. But another good tennis mind, soft-spoken, but a shark inside, right? Great business person, you know, the force behind Billy and keeps Billy working, keeps the sponsorship coming. But you're right. I mean, South Africans have had a big, big, big influence on tennis.
Yeah, I think it's going to continue. I have some interesting plans, and I'm pretty instinctive about what I've done all my life in tennis. You know, I come from a farming community of 500 people, and we have 2 cement courts in that town, and that's how I learned to play tennis. And was discovered when I was 10, like, you know, this kid is not just going to be a great rugby player, but he should really play tennis because he's talented. So that's how I got to be a boarding school student in Pretoria. In the Afrikaans High Boys High School, which is the Afrikaans school, but Elon Musk went to the school on the other side of the street. So kind of an interesting tidbit. But, you know, Africa has been left in the dust for too many decades.
Yes.
And I have some ideas how to get things going again.
Yeah.
So I'm on a war path to get tennis back in Africa and really, really make a difference for the legacy of junior tennis and just basic tennis tournaments. There are no South Africa, there are no ATP or WTA pro tournaments south of the Sahara Desert. That leaves 1.1 billion people without that opportunity, like I had to go and watch the South African Open and meet Bjorn Borg when he was 16 and a half years old, coming out to play his first pro tournaments. He went to South Africa. I was in high school. I was 13 and a half years old, and I was invited to go and watch the tournament. Arthur Ashe was there, Jimmy Connors, all these guys. And I just knew at age 13 and a half, that's what I was going to do. So it's really it's a sad state of affairs that things have over the decades been neglected. And Africa has been left to fend for itself in whatever tournaments and junior events they could run up. But we really truly need some new ideas and some new blood to come in there and pump tennis in a continent that has been neglected, unfortunately.
Yeah, and when you think about African tennis now, all we hear about is people leaving. We hear Africans going to France, going to Spain, right? Just sort of being extracted, right? Yeah. It's, you know, being told that you can't develop in the continent. You got to go elsewhere to get good, right? And then what happens is, you know, they lose their heritage. They spend so much time in France or Paris or whatever. Then the coaches take them and, you know, make them seem like they discovered them, right? You know what I mean? And not give any credit to how good they were before you took them out of their native land.
I would love to change that. I think we have the opportunity, especially in South Africa and maybe broader spectrum, Southern Africa, and start building on a platform by which we think we can get some very powerful people behind us to make this happen, bring professional tournaments back, just like we had in South Africa back in the day. It was the 5th oldest tournament in the world, started in late 1800s. and really, really revive it and do something so unbelievable that the rest of the world is going to look at us and go, wow, we didn't know that Africa could do this. And, you know, I've lived most of my adult life in America. I'm a South African at heart. I've been a U.S. citizen since 1982. But I think myself and some very interesting people are very, very, very serious about this effort. And that goes to the highest level of both men and women tennis.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say the same thing. Like in Chicago, we try to take a cradle to grave approach. If you cannot, you know, people want to play basketball, but they can buy a ticket to a Bulls game.
Right.
But if you cannot get close to pro tennis, you never believe that you can do it. Right. You never fall in love with it. You know what I mean? And so, I meet so many people on tour that were ball kids for Roger Federer, right? Or a ball kid for somebody else. And it's like a lot of careers just start with that, just being, have an opportunity to be a ball kid or to play on a court next to a professional like they do in Czech Republic, right? And, you know, in America, we've got to, South Africa, you got to keep these tournaments alive so that kids sort of see it to be it. So we're trying to do the same thing in Chicago.
Yeah. No, I mean, South Africa has got great tennis programming for juniors. I mean, they have academies there. They got ITF tournaments. There's a ton of ITF stuff in Southern Africa. The problem is once the kids get to 15, 16 years old, you know, they have to leave. They have to go to Europe. They have to go to America. They got to be exposed to that higher echelon. It's a very different time now than when I was even a young junior and upcoming. I was just absolutely unbelievably fortunate that my foundation coach in Pretoria was this guy, Ian Cunningham. He's now passed away some years ago, but Ian took me under his wing and he became sort of my second dad. You know, I was in high school, I was in boarding school. There was no such thing as an online school, you know, that you can do things and you play your sport and you can do your education. There's nothing like that. It was like either you do your education in sports secondary, right?
Right.
But I just went to the schoolmaster one day and I said, at 17, I said, I'm not going to finish my final year in high school. I'm going to go play professional tennis. The guy looked at me in stunned disbelief and said, can you make even money out of that? And I just didn't know what to say because I've never been on a tour, so I didn't know how much money the guys would make.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm going to try, I guess, you know. And he says, your parents would like for you to go? I said, yeah, they okay. They would like. So my coach had emigrated to Austria, of all places, cold place. And I left the heat of summer in February of 76. And I ended up flying to Zurich, Switzerland. They picked me up. And I lived in Austria for 3 years. Luckily, just plain blind luck. My coach had got a job there from South Africa to emigrate to Austria, got a job at a club. And I learned to play on red clay. And that's really how my lucky stars turned out to be. You know, a very, very fortunate situation because I could now play on red clay and I played indoors and I got to play tournaments in France and England and Germany and, you know, just traveled around by train a lot.
So easy once you're in Europe to compete in tournaments everywhere.
That's why there's so many good players out of Europe, I think. It's because the countries are so close together. So the competition is amazing.
Yeah.
The opportunities there are way, way more conducive to have a bunch of people play well because it's easy travel, it's close enough, tons of tournament, tons of different. I love the way the French actually go about their program because it's sort of more of a don't stifle the talent, you know, so that you see the French, they play very different from the Spanish, right? The Spanish are all pretty much the same. It's kind of like you got to get the mold from Roger, from Nadal, right?
Right, right.
Whereas the French are very, very rainbowish. You know, they let people kind of develop in their own way, and the coaches are very well supported. They got a great system in France, I think. And you know, but they've had over the years tremendous amount of players coming out of France as well.
Oh yeah, France, Italy now is coming along. It's just amazing.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
So what I find ironic is that you trained a lot on clay in Austria,
Yeah.
So why did you not play the French Open from 1980 to 1985?
You know, that's a very good question.
I mean, you played all three slams except that one.
I just, you know, the first time I played on clay was 17 years old. And so I just didn't feel the push. I just didn't feel that comfortable on it. And so I didn't play the French until 1986. I decided, okay, you know, my then wife wanted to go shopping in Paris, and I haven't been to Paris. And there was a big joke in Le Figaro or something, because I did so well. I got to the semis. I said, you know what? My wife's going to go shopping, and she wants to see Paris. And we did the whole nine yards, the Eiffel Tower. We did all that. And I said, you know what? People think I can't play in this.
You're running from it. They think you're doing a Roger Federer, right? Where you like take a little vacation, start your grass court season early. I mean, you know, like I was like, yeah. I was looking at your record, like, what is the deal? You play all four slams, final eight in all of them, or play the other three. Not like you were injured, right? It was like you just chose not to play the French, like Roger.
Well, back then it was just sort of weird. It's just like I didn't feel like I could stay in Europe that long, even though at that time I was living in Florida already. I lived in Naples, which is funny. I'm here in Naples today. So I just, you know, I was one of those players, you know, when I give it my all, I play 3-4 weeks in a row. I couldn't stand play, you know, maybe Hamburg or then warm up for or Rome and then go to the French and then have a week off practice. It was just for me too long in Europe. I just got brain dead. So I said, you know what, I got to come back and prepare, because I had already done so well on grass. And I think that I need to prepare for the grass court season. I did fairly well at Wimbledon. I got to the quarters twice and a couple of 16s, but I never really quite. I felt like the weather in Wimbledon really affected my tennis too much. One day it rains and, you know, my final year is 1993. I qualified, I think, 16 years apart. For the first time I played Wimbledon, I qualified. And then I qualified when I was injured. I had three surgeries. I was coming back. I was 36 years old. I qualified and lost to Javier Sanchez in the first round of Wimbledon. I played 5 days on one match. I mean, it was just ridiculous. The weather just wrecked us. But and then in 86, I just thought, you know what? I'm going to really give it a shot. I'm going to really try very hard at the French. I practiced really hard in Florida. In the summer in early May, and went to the French Open, and I played free. I had no expectations. Nobody thought I was going to do well, and I beat some good players on clay, including Vilas on center court in the quarters. And I beat him 3-6, 7-6, 7-6, 7-6, 4 hours, 48 minutes, and I was dead. I was dead. I mean, I had to play Lendl 2 days later. I couldn't even get out of bed. Honestly, they looked at me and they go, I think you should just default. I said, nobody defaults in the semis of a slam.
Are you kidding me? No.
You know, I mean,
no way.
If you can crawl on the court, you play. But it's so funny that 2 days before I played Vilas, it was super hot. It was like in the 90s in France. It was ridiculous. And I love the heat. So I played well. And then I had like a day off. I stayed in bed. I was dead. I was completely spent. But I had a bunch of five-set matches before that as well. So it wasn't just that one match. But then I played Lendl, and it was 50 degrees. It was so cold. It was the first time ever. And it was windy and snotty rain, a little bit of rain. And they made us play. And it was so cold that the tournament, for the first time in the history of the Grand Slams, they allowed us to play with a full tracksuit on. So I played. I mean, I just couldn't play. I was just dead. So Lendl had a basic easy 3-set walkover, and then he beat Bernfors in the finals.
Now, you were there during that golden era, and I remember back in 1984, 1982, John McEnroe went 81-4. Now you, got some wins over Johnny Mack. What was that year like? We almost saw a year like that last year with Iga Swiatek, right? Yeah. Where she just was on a run, right? I don't know if she won, 34, 35 matches in a row or something like that. But what was that year like with Johnny Mack on that run, only losing 4 matches?
I mean, you know, obviously, John was a very, very talented, unusually talented player that came into an era where there were some really tough players, and the guys were incredibly vivid characters, not just on the tennis court, but just the way that they are as people, you know. And when I played Mac in 82. I played him a couple of times. In 82, I beat him in the finals of Memphis in the U.S. National Indoor Championships, which was kind of funny because I had just won, I think early January, I won my 82 Australian Open, and these guys were not there. So the newspapers were like, oh, well, Crick is coming to Memphis, and McEnroe is going to be there, Connors is going to be there. I don't think he's in the same league as these guys. And I just sort of like use that as a bit of fuel. And I got to play John McEnroe in the finals in 82 in Memphis, and really great TV match. And I beat him 6-4 in a third. And I was really playing good tennis. And I thought, you know, I've arrived. I mean, I can play with these guys anytime I want. You know, it's just a matter of how you conduct yourself and how you practice and how you feel how you get on the court with them. And, you know, so I got him a couple of other times in San Francisco. I played some really great matches. I pretty much beat John mostly on indoor forest carpet, which is funny. That's kind of his best surface. But I always felt like his best surface was Wimbledon because that lefty swing serve back in those days was so low and so quick, and it's so hard to pass him, you know, with his serve and volley tactic stuff. He was nearly unbeatable at some of these tournaments, and he obviously showed in 84 that he was at the absolute prime of his career. But I'm you know, in tennis, maybe more so then back then than maybe today, there's certain the styles of tennis back in the day was a little bit more serve and volley, some guys more grinder, some guys, but today you just everybody serves big, everybody grinds big with very little opportunistic volleys, and there's no real serve and volley tactics. So it's more like, let me serve and volley because I'm up 5-1, 40 love, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a little different, but yeah, Mac was, he was an amazing talent, and, you know, Lendl came through, and Connors was there, and Borg was there. And then you got the younger cater coming in with Boris Becker and Mats Wilander and Stefan Edberg. And then you get later on, you got Agassi and Sampras, and then I missed Sampras by one day. I played Agassi a bunch of times, beat him a few times, but missed Sampras by a day, and, you know, played a lot of guys. You know, I even played against Ken Rosewall in doubles one time in Sydney, Australia. And this guy was 44 years old. We almost lost to him. Amazing guy, amazing player. So, yeah, I had a very, very interesting career, very fortunate.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Now, you're playing a tournament in Chicago. You know, I'm, you know, trying to sort of make tennis more exciting in Chicago. It's a cold weather climate. People really don't know about the rich tennis history in Chicago. You beat one of the all-time great personalities in Chicago, Yannick Noah.
Yeah.
Where did you all play the event?
It was indoors. I thought was it called the Rosemont Arena or something?
Oh, Rosemont. Yes, Rosemont Horizon.
Yeah, Rosemont Horizon. Exactly. I think we played there. I may be wrong, but I think we played there. But this is a really interesting story. So, first of all, my history with Yannick Noah is quite interesting because in 1978 or 79, I think I got to go back in the archives and look. You know, my brain is a bit foggy, but I beat Yannick at the US Open 6-4 in a fifth. So here's a white South African playing a black guy from Cameroon, and we're both from Africa, and, you know, apartheid South Africa, and people made a big deal out of it. Yeah, we were just athletes. We were just out there freaking busting our ass. I got lucky. I beat him 6-4 in a fifth. So Yannick and I have been friends for a long time. I mean, we were sponsored by the same Le Coq Sportif company. I had a lot of French companies that I was playing for, including Rossignol Rackets, Le Coq Sportif. You know, lots of Peugeot was a sponsor for me, a car company. So I've had a long relationship with Yannick. He beat me a few times. I beat him a few times. And then we got to Chicago, and, you know, it's a big tournament back then, like a Masters 1000, essentially, back then. And Connors plays McEnroe in the finals. And Saturday night, Yannick Noah and I just decided to, you know, let's play a little doubles together. I've never played doubles with him before. Okay. So I said, Yannick, you want to play doubles? He says, yeah, sure, I'll play doubles. And We get to the finals and we got to play Flex Segusa, number one doubles team in the world. Right. Me and Yannick, I mean, you know, Yannick is a superb athlete and I'm pretty good. I jump around and I can volley like crazy and he's athletic as hell. Right. So we kind of gelled a little bit, you know. Right. The first few matches were kind of rough and we beat a bunch of guys. And then we got to the finals. But so Connors has to play McEnroe in the finals. And I think Connors got the flu and he can't play at all. Completely in bed. He can't move. And so the tournament director is up in arms. He's got 2.5 hours of television. You know, he's got a decent double setup, you know, with these four guys. So he comes up to, he calls us. He says, guys, can I meet with you guys in the hotel? So he came and he says, listen, Connors definitely ill. He can't move. McEnroe has a walkover. You know, I got 2.5 hours of television. What do you guys think? Do you mind playing a 5-set final? And we said, sure, no problem. He says, yeah, I'll throw some extra money in or something. Everybody got extra $5,000 or something. We said, hey, that's fine. That's great. So Yannick and I start playing. And I mean, Flax Segusa is right away in their groove. And, you know, they're number one doubles team in the world at the time. They've won Wimbledon. They won US Open. Here comes Yannick Noah and I, like pickup partners, you know, like Central Park, New York. And we get smashed the first two sets. And suddenly we started to play. And we ended up beating them in 5 sets, exactly 2.5 hours in doubles. The tournament director was so happy. It was an unbelievable match. I mean, we basically saved the tournament because it was such fun. I mean, we were running into the stands and high-fiving people and Yannick is diving and he's jumping like a grasshopper over people and hitting overheads from the side. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was really fun. So I remember that vividly, that it was one of those sort of off-the-cuff moments in tennis that you didn't expect and then it turns into something spectacular.
Oh, man. Well, you know, it's funny you say, you talk about saving the tournament, because when I think of like U.S. tennis, similar to sort of the question on with South Africa, you know, you mentioned Memphis, right? That event is gone. Chicago, that event is gone. Los Angeles had an event, right? Tampa, you know what I mean? Like all of these events that were just such good, prominent stops on the tour and now are gone. What do you think we have to do? Because you talked about the European advantage, really. Once you go to Europe, you can train from, you know, you take a train to Austria, to Strasbourg, to Paris, to, you know, everywhere else you can just get around, right? And you can play every single week, good tennis, even their team tennis over there. A lot of people don't know, a lot of the French players play this team tennis and make money.
Yeah, I played team tennis in Austria. It was fantastic.
You know what I mean? With like full of pros. It's like, what do you think we have to do where we can create a pipeline, now that you're sort of U.S. citizen now, right? Create a pipeline where the U.S. players can play every week, get around affordably, have tournaments stay multi-years instead of, you know, one-year deals, one-year leases on sanctions, right? Because that's why I think we see Italy now pop up with Sinner and Musetti and, you know, Berrettini, right? And Paris, same thing. I mean, or France, I mean, same thing. It's like we're just losing at the lower level, whether it's the 80K, the 100K, the 125s, and travel and cost in America when we are the richest nation, right? And we should be able to make this work.
Right. I think there's three things. I think the size of America is a detriment in a way.
It's big.
You know, it's not Europe. Europe, you jump here in Holland and you're in Belgium. And you're French, right? America, you drive 8 hours in the car, you still haven't left Florida. I mean, right. You know, so I think geographically, I think America is a little bit different. But secondly, I think the culture of sport in America is completely different from Europe. Tennis in Europe is probably top three. You know, soccer is number one, maybe cricket and some other things. But tennis is very high up on the totem pole for the public to love tennis, okay? Mm-hmm. There are tremendous facilities in Europe, indoors and outdoors. And thirdly, I think that the way that television has, you know, wrapped its arms around the team sports in America, I don't think you're going to ever fight that. Mm. You know, the team sports in Europe is basically soccer, you know. Mm-hmm. So the culture is very different in America. So, you know, you got NASCAR, which is also a sport. If you have a lot of money, you win. But, you know, you got football, basketball, you got baseball, you got ice hockey. I mean, tennis is seventh or eighth on the totem pole in America. So I don't know how you will be able to entice, you know, tennis is a very expensive sport versus soccer or basketball.
Right.
So it's a cost factor. And, you know, it is sad to see tennis go through its gyrations in America in some instances. But, you know, obviously college tennis is also impacted very heavily. A lot of programs dropped from colleges, D1, D2. A very unfortunate situation. But, yeah, I mean, I'm always a bit surprised that there wasn't more team tennis, in a sense, like you've got these club tennis things. But that's, again, it's a cultural thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tennis has drastically changed over the last number of decades. I mean, when I lived in Austria, for instance, when we go to the club, even in that small town where I was living with my coach at his apartment, we would go to the tennis club and you would basically spend the whole weekend there. I mean, you eat there, you play doubles in the morning, you play singles, whatever. You're there all day.
Right.
And today's marketplace, it seems like people go to the tennis club and they play and they don't even shower there. They just go. They leave.
Yeah. Yeah. They go, take a lesson, 2 hours, or out.
Yeah, they're gone. It's not a destination per se like it was.
Mm-hmm.
And Europe's very different. Your club becomes a destination. Now, a gate, I'm not talking about gated community, fancy homes, fancy places, fancy clubs. Yeah, people will hang a little bit. But that's a completely different model. These are just, you know, people just join a club and it's for the public and you can just go. And it's a real destination. People have fun events and they, you know, I remember, you know, burning the witches for winter and Austria and all these, you know, really cool things during the seasons that you do at the club. And it was really a gathering point for the town and for people that are into tennis. And you know, everybody knows tennis and it's a big part of their culture, but tennis is not a massive cultural thing in America. It's an elitist sport in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a truly a global sport. I just would like to see the map of Africa become a little bit more cluttered with some real stuff, and I think I'm on the path to get some done.
Okay, so you've got two young ones at play now, 10 and 12.
Yeah.
How is that experience? You know, I mean, I've tried to raise my daughter to play, got 5 and 7 year old boy, trying to get them to love it. You know, they want to go to the tennis club and play basketball. You know what I mean? So I'm trying to, they can stroke it though. You know, they don't play that often, but the time they spend on the court is very sort of rigorous. So, I mean, they pick up the small racket in like perfect strokes. You know what I mean? So what's your experience like dealing with this new breed of tennis parent? Right, where their kid can do no wrong, looking for every advantage. Their kid, you know, the ball was in. You know what I mean? When it was really out, you know what I mean? It's just, it's rough.
It's an experience, you know. I honestly, you know, what gives me a little bit more of a roadmap before I got to this point is the fact that I've had my tennis academy business now for almost 18 years,
mm-hmm.
so I've seen it all.
Mm-hmm.
And nevertheless, it is very hard for a person like me who has been at that very high level to sit next to a tennis court and see the shenanigans going on. But it's not really unique to America. I mean, it's the same everywhere else. I mean, I hear the same stories in South Africa. I hear the same stories in England, and the same with Tennis Australia. You know, I guess it's just the nature of the beast, you know?
Yeah.
But I really instill in my kids a sense of fair play. And, you know, we try to be, I mean, I've been where I could have pulled my hair out and I could have punched somebody, or, you know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, the cheating and stuff like that. But, you know, I just try and also, you know where we are. And it's, these kids are 12 years old. They're not professional tennis players yet. And to chill and just to, you know, it's hard. It's hard because I'm hyper competitive. Let's put it that way. And I hate to see my kids hurt, but at the same time, also, they have to know that losing is going to happen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And only through losing do you actually learn more than when you win a lot.
Mm-hmm.
To win a lot in the 10s and 12s is almost a death wish.
Yes.
Very, very few of them come out of there and continue to win, because the kids that are working super hard are tiny little tots, and they work hard and they can take a punch and they got the toughness and the mental toughness and they fit and they're strong. They keep grinding, they keep fighting. Doesn't matter how many times they get knocked down, how many times they lose first round, how many times they lose in the finals. They could have tiebreakers and they lose all of them. Those are the ones that eventually make it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the ones that consistently win all the time that get to be the top.
Yeah.
And so it's a, you know, it's a grind, and it's very expensive. I mean, we spend a lot of time with our kids. You know, even at my academy, they come and train quite a bit. You know, we're trying to expose them. It's a wonderful sport, and I just don't know exactly where it's going to end up, but it's a priority for us to give our kids the most utmost of advice and support and direction and guidance to do what they possibly could do. And they both are pretty good.
Well, one of the things that I do like about junior tennis, and I think that the parents will look back, even through the chaos of being a tennis parent, when you look back at how much time you were forced to spend with your kid.
Oh, yeah.
In the car, on the plane, sharing a hotel room, watching lessons, pick up balls. That, I think, is that one-on-one time, right? That kid feels that investment in it. And yep. I mean, that, I think, is one of the things that tennis does give that a team sport doesn't. You know, I mean, I get so much joy out of seeing fathers spending time with their daughters.
Yeah.
You know, pushing them to compete and letting them know that it's okay for a girl to compete and be mean and be nasty, right? You know what I mean? And, you know, so like to attach themselves to result. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I remember that I know your tennis experience was a little different, but, you know, my parents didn't play tennis at all. My mother never saw me hit a tennis ball ever right. in my tennis career, right? But I do, I'm sure you know, like being there for your kid, sharing a hotel room, being in the car, it's like a real treat and gives you a real chance in this day to actually shape your kid versus letting the iPad, the video game, the Instagram.
I couldn't agree more with you. I think sport in general is the antithesis of these cell phones and these iPads. I mean, it is part of our, that technology is part of our world now. You just can't get away from it. But I just see, I mean, kids sitting, you know, at a restaurant and nobody's talking to each other and they're all on their cell phone. Sure, you see people at a beautiful the Louvre, you know, looking at paintings, and it's like they're on their cell phone, sitting on a bench. You know, it's just like horrendous. But it is part of the new world that we are in. And but yeah, I think sport is just extremely important for kids. I mean, and tennis in particular is such a one-on-one, self-reliance taught sport that makes you feel like you pull your hair out some days, you know, and then you the next week you win something, or you win a match, or you play somebody that you never beat before. Now you beat them, and you feel that sense of satisfaction for your children and how they fought so hard, you know. And now you've lost to a kid 5-6 times in a row, and now suddenly they start pushing them, and then they win. It's just such a great feeling to see that sense of accomplishment, because it really is a one-on-one sport. It's probably one of the greatest life lessons that you can learn for yourself, to be tough and self-reliant. It's the sport of tennis.
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, man, I really appreciate your time. I know you're there with your kids at a tournament doing the tennis dad thing. Yep. I'm sure you're sitting on your hands right during the match, right? Just
trying to be quiet.
Stay calm. Yeah. But, you know, you're a legend in the game and an ambassador for not only South Africa, but all of tennis. And, you know, your name is infamous, right? When you think about the tennis legends from South Africa, pioneers. And I want to thank you for coming on the show and wish you good luck. In any way I can participate in the quest to bring tennis back to South Africa and the continent in general, let me know. You know, the reason why I actually started playing tennis was my dad took my brother's basketball team to Senegal.
No way.
West Africa.
Yeah.
And we came back to the States July 27th. All the summer camps were full in my neighborhood except for tennis camp. Because no one in my neighborhood wanted to play tennis. I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood, low-income area. No one wanted to play tennis, right?
Right.
So my mom took me to the park. The instructor said, it's $12 for the rest of the summer, and we have room. And she said, boy, get out the car. So, you know, lots of my tennis career started because of that long trip to Africa with my parents in the summer. So it's, you know,
amazing. Yeah.
Beautiful place. I love going there. And, you know, I appreciate you, brother.
Well, I tell you what, we are all just crazy about this sport. I've been playing tennis since I was 4 years old. I've never lost my want and desire to do it. Now coaching and seeing the fruits of my labor with kids and, you know, putting kids in college even, and then kids that never played tennis before, or even a kid that was a volleyball champion, tries and picks up tennis, starts to love it so much, got a full right D1 for tennis and volleyball. I mean, you know, to hear those stories when you do that for kids over many years, I mean, it's just parents thanking you every year, writing you a Christmas note saying, you know, she's doing so-and-so, she's now married, she still plays tennis, she's at the club. And just the game of tennis is such an influence on so many people on so many levels. It's not always just the, you know, it's the glamour of the Shangri-La story of winning Wimbledon and winning, that's, you know, that's one thing. And it's in itself some amazingly accomplished for many coaches. But just to change lives and be able to affect people's lives, I mean, that's the big thing. So that's really the goal for us. And I think we have some fantastic people, like I said, from the highest level of our sport, as well as sponsors and others that are iconic people in the world of so many business opportunities and so forth that want to see this happen for us. So, yeah, it's we are getting going. And as soon as the dam will burst one of these days and everybody will know what we're doing. So it's going to be very exciting, very, very exciting. I mean, it's a whole continent. I mean, it's not just one country. It's a whole continent that we want to awaken to tennis. I cannot be the only one that's ever won a Grand Slam twice. There should be many more Roger Federers and Serena Williams is coming out of Africa. Yeah. That's for sure. Yannick Noah's, all of these guys. And, you know, North Africa is pretty much Franco-Africa. You know, it's a bit more French. Yeah. So the French has a lot of influence there. And you had 20 tennis tournaments in Tunisia. You got Egypt. You got Morocco. There's some others. But Sub-Saharan Africa has been left in the dust. So time for us to step up. And, you know, people like myself, I'm very, very keen to do that. And spent a lot of time in South Africa as well. My kids can't wait for them to see where dad came from. Look at a few lions and giraffes and elephants and have some fun with that as well. But it's going to be a pretty amazing opportunity.
Well, I can't let you go since we are Australian Open time. And that is, you know, your place, right? Two-time champion there. Well, who's your pick for the Australian Open?
Well, I tell you what, Djokovic looks awfully strong. You know, I think, you know, he has a bone to pick.
he has a bone to pick.
He does have a bone to pick. And, you know, the way they treated him was quite disgusting, in my opinion. But that's life. You get over it, you move on, and you do your best you can. And I think he has a bone to pick, and he's something to prove. And I think he's going to be definitely the greatest of all time because he's just one of those unique athletes that come along once in a lifetime. So I would pick Djokovic. Swiatek is a bit of a blip right now. She's starting to be hauled in by some of the girls. And Pegula beat up 2-2 yesterday. I saw that match. And
2-2.
Yeah, 2-2. I mean, Jessica, she practiced at Whitfield, where I work with this up-and-coming WTA player. And she practiced with this Jessica Pegula and stuff. And Pegula looks good. You know, she played really well yesterday. So she could be very much a dark horse in the tournament. So I would say Swiatek probably will gain a little bit more confidence and go to her next gear. Pegula just played her and didn't let her play her own game yesterday. She was Swiatek looked a little bit off, but that's tennis, right? I saw Alcaraz got injured. He's not playing.
Yep.
What did he do? I didn't see.
I don't know the details on it yet, but I saw the blip that came across the screen. I said, "Oh, opportunity." I mean, I thought he was probably the one person that physically could match Djokovic.
Absolutely.
But with him gone, you know, and Rafa sort of, you know, maybe not being 100%, you know, Djokovic, he's definitely, and the extra, I mean, Djokovic is a player that doesn't really need any extra motivation, but when he has it, I mean, you know.
No, he's the greatest of all time. He'll surpass everybody with Grand Slams. I mean, he's got another 5 years of tennis in him.
Yeah.
You can imagine he just wins one of those five. It's five already. I mean, he's at 25 Grand Slams. These other guys are at 121, 22. So, I mean, I would say he's probably going to be there. But, you know, other great guys is, you know, Rude is always knocking. I think Rune.
Yeah, Rune. Holger Rune. Yeah.
Holger could be making a move. He's a strong guy. But I tell you what, I like this French guy that played Djokovic yesterday in Auckland. Halis, tall guy. Djokovic beat him 7-6, 7-6. And I'm telling you, Djokovic had to play unbelievably good tennis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a point here and a point there that made the difference. But this guy's good. He's got a monster serve. I mean, he was serving constantly 118, 119, 120 second serves.
Mm-hmm.
And he could be a dark horse in the tournament as well. But I just love tennis. We have TVs on and it's just tennis everywhere. Every day is just tennis. So, but I appreciate the time. I really do. And don't be a stranger. Let's talk in the next couple of months and see where we are with Africa and see what we can do together.
All right, brother. Well, this has been the Tennis.com podcast with the man, the myth, the legend, Yohai Creek.
The myth is good.
The myth. <that. laughs> Yeah, the grass court Australian Open, right?
Yeah, that's fun. That was a good time.
Thank you for joining.
You're welcome, buddy. All the best. Good luck with everything.